This is Liz Kafidi at UN News. With half of Afghanistan's children under five at risk of severe malnutrition and two-thirds of the country needing humanitarian assistance, the UN's Emergency Relief Coordinator is urging the international community to provide real commitments at a crucial aid conference on Monday. In an exclusive interview for UN News in Geneva, ahead of the conference, Daniel Johnson sat down with the newly installed head of UN Humanitarian Affairs, Martin Griffiths, who recently returned from his first visit to Afghanistan, now under Taliban control. He called on the Taliban to recognize the scale of need across the country and urge them to respect the rights of women and girls.
What we need on Monday is a focus of the international community on the needs of the people in Afghanistan. These needs have grown enormously because of recent weeks in Afghanistan, and we all understand that. But what Monday is about is an opportunity for us to describe to member states our needs, the needs of the people of Afghanistan, and for them to pledge a partnership with us to meet those needs in very difficult circumstances.
You were in Kabul very recently, and you met the Taliban interim leaders at the time. There were some women there. Now, people are desperate to know about women's rights and securing women's and girls' rights going forward. What would you say to them?
Well, look, I've worked with the Taliban and around the Taliban and despite the Taliban for 20, 25 years. And I negotiated with them in 1998 when they were last in power on exactly the same issues that we were addressing earlier this week with them. I raised two issues with the Taliban leadership, the first of which was the rights of women and girls to all that is normal in society, whether it's work, whether it's education, whether it's freedom of movement, all these things. And secondly, I spoke to them about what is needed as an environment in which humanitarian agencies can flourish and function. But on the first, what they said to me was that we promise that the rights of women and girls will be respected, subject to the religion and culture of Afghanistan. This is a work in progress, and we've been here before, and so we need to have a lot more discussion in the days to come and the weeks to come about what that really means. And that's very important for the people of Afghanistan, but it's also important for the international community.
Because, of course, there have been demonstrations in the center of Kabul, and we've heard reports of whips being used, so that isn't something that is acceptable to the international community, presumably. Although I suppose you would say your priorities now are those most in need. So can you tell us about those needs?
If I could first say, and this is what the Taliban themselves told me when I was there in Kabul, is that they have come to power sooner than they thought. They're unprepared for this. They look around the country and we see completely different practices in different parts of the country. I spoke to the leaders of NGOs in Kabul, some of whom were saying that in certain provinces, they were treated very well by the Taliban, that women were treated well by the Taliban, and in others, exactly the sort of practices that you've described. So there's a completely incomplete history of commitment at the moment. We need to make sure that the Taliban does understand throughout Afghanistan what we think is necessary. In terms of the needs, the launch of the flash appeal on Monday under the Secretary General's auspices will be for just a little over $600 million for 4 months. And the needs range right through from helping those affected by the drought in terms of food security. Half of the children under five are thought to be at risk of severe malnutrition. Two-thirds of the country need humanitarian assistance, and that was even before recent events. So we have reassessed humanitarian needs, added more because of the circumstances now, and what we will be hoping to see on Monday is our pledges and commitments to allow us to go forward. Let me give you one example. I met in Kabul with a number of internally displaced people. They had fled to Kabul to get out of the conflict, and they were now being housed in a camp in the middle of the city. So I went to talk to them and I said, what do you want? Two-thirds of those we spoke to wanted to go back home. One-third still didn't trust the Taliban that they would be treated properly back home. For the two-thirds who wanted to go back home, all they needed was the price of transport and some help to repair damages to their houses and their community. Money well spent, you would imagine, if we want to stabilize the region and if we want to enable people to stay in Afghanistan instead of fleeing to neighboring countries and beyond. So early money, early expenditure, focused and targeted expenditure, that's what we hope to see supported on Monday.
Humanitarian workers need assurances of safety to work. Did you get those from the Taliban?
Yes, I went into some detail with the Mullah Barada and his advisors on the conditions for humanitarian operations. And I emphasize that these are conditions everywhere in the world, and they include safety and security of humanitarian workers, as you say. Secondly, independence. Independence to employ whomever the humanitarian agency desires, both men and women. Of course, we insisted on that. Independence of assessment, independence of need, identification of need, independence of delivery, and then of monitoring. So the operation is independent and is controlled by the humanitarian agencies involved. Mullah Barada, who is one of the top leaders of the movement in this new administration, confirmed support for all of those elements. This is essentially a description of the humanitarian space within which agencies operate. He is now turning, at my request, those oral commitments into written assurances. And we hope to have that letter from him with us on Monday here in Geneva.
Just very quickly, the final question on the new Taliban leadership. You say you were talking to them in the late 90s and now today. So can you sense any change between the two?
Well, let me tell you what others told me. For example, the representatives of the region, Pakistan and Qatar. And they told me this, and we saw it also directly. They said, what the Taliban leadership understand very clearly this time round is how much they need the international community to deliver the aid that we've been talking about for the people. Because, as they say, there is a very, very difficult economic situation, for the banks are closed, there's no money in the system, people aren't paid salaries, local institutions are at risk. So the Taliban are as conscious of that as you and I are. So they need us to be there. And I think that drives them making the sort of commitments that they made to me. And hopefully that will drive their behavior when we move from promises into practice.
Afghanistan is in the international spotlight now, and let's hope it stays that way, but other crises are not. Syria, one of them, you were there very recently. There's been a flare-up in the southwest, still misery in the northeast, in the northwest. What's the state of play there, and how is the funding for the humanitarian needs?
I did go to Syria, my first time in Syria for a number of years, and what was striking to me about it, as told to me by people who'd worked there for humanitarian agencies for some years, this conflict has been going on for 10 years, as you know, is the needs of ordinary Syrian families have never been higher than today. I was appalled by this. And this is because of a combination of the conflict, of humanitarian displacement and so forth, of the economy of Syria, which has been so battered, because of course there's no investment, there's an impact of sanctions on economic activity, and we're only able to support resilience and recovery as opposed to development, and I understand why. But even the resilience and recovery, which looks to livelihoods and basic services, is very, very inadequately funded. So I came away from Syria saying, it's a $4 billion a year program, 25% funded. I'm sure the $4 billion is needed, but it's only a quarter of that is being provided, and the needs are growing. So all the arrows are going in the wrong direction in Syria. And we need to stand back for a minute and look at how we engage with this clearly unsustainable situation for the people of Syria. So I came away from Syria wanting to keep attention to it, but also wanting to have a careful and clear look at whether we're doing the right things there.
Well, that begs the question, how will you go forward doing that? Work the phones? You've spoken to the humanitarian community. What are the priorities there? Might they be different? Is that what you're saying?
No, I think the needs of ordinary people in Syria are for basic services. How do we fund that? How do we increase the level of funding for that element of the humanitarian program? At the moment, it's only 10%. Well, that's not good enough. We need to have many more projects developed and much more donor interest in that area. We also, of course, need to sustain current approach, which has cross-border and cross-line. We managed to get one convoy across the line in the northwest after weeks and weeks of negotiations. How do we make that easier to manage and easier to run? And for those involved in the cross-border operation, to have a certain sense of security and certainty that that operation is going to continue beyond 6 months or 12 months. So we have practical operational problems in Syria. We also have to understand what is the consequence of the fact that, frankly, we're not meeting the needs of Syrian people.